Good afternoon, Chancellor, esteemed guests, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Elizabeth Spencer, Acting Dean of the College of Business Law and Governance at James Cook University. And Simon, like your mom, my dad was in Townsville in 1942. But he left his heart with an 18-year-old in Brisbane, so whom he later married. Anyway, on behalf of all of us, I would very much like to thank Belinda Allen and Simon Jackson for your excellent and thought-provoking presentations today. The audience will have many questions, I'm sure, about what all of this means for us in a global context, and of course in a local one for Townsville and the region. So could we please ask members of the audience who have questions to raise your hand and the microphone will be brought to you? Please stand and state your name, organization, and your question. We would ask that you refrain from making long comments in order to allow time for other questions. I might, if I may, take the liberty of asking the first question. So, in our own backyard, we are sensitive to issues around tertiary education, and as you mentioned, Simon, it would be good for us to talk about that, and its importance in job creation and in other ways. And my question is this, is tertiary education a government service or an important export, albeit one vulnerable to the vicissitudes of foreign economic, political, and social conditions? And what should be the Australian government posture to the governance and support of tertiary education?
Well, there's an interesting story that goes with that, and right now you hear senior bureaucrats and politicians from both sides of politics sort of admonishing Australian vice chancellors, you need to diversify, you need to spread the risk, spread your exposure away from China. But if I understand the JCU story, it's like, you'd like a little more exposure to China. That's not the story at University of Sydney, University of New South Wales, some of the big volume-based businesses, frankly, down south. There, I think university administrators and certainly the Australian government, with this new sense of the multifaceted nature of strategic risks and opportunities, understand that higher ed is implicated, number one. You cannot tell a story about Australian economic growth anymore, or a balance of payments at least, without mentioning the higher ed sector. But the reliance on China as a market is a source of real angst for all sorts of reasons. It makes us very vulnerable in all sorts of ways. But, comma, back to the policy question, what is a rational vice chancellor to do? The Australian higher ed sector is sort of, reminds me sometimes of the worst of both worlds. It reminds me of sort of like East Germany in the 80s economically. You have very, you're in a market, but you're not really in a market. We want you to go out and think commercially, but we're going to regulate the daylights out of you. And so what's a rational vice chancellor to do? They had one degree of freedom to innovate on, and that was to open the spigot on foreign enrolments for a revenue source as support from Canberra goes up or goes down from year to year. So I think it's, if the Australian government wants to see Australian universities diversify away from a reliance on Chinese foreign students, the Australian government has to come to the party and either putting some resources up on the research side or finding some funding that gives universities an incentive and an ability to make that move if they want to see it happen. So we are in a regulated space. Your opening question, is it a government service or is it a business? It's a bit of both, but understanding if you want the university sector that respond to sort of nationally strategic imperatives, then I think you've got to understand that sort of their limited ability to do that commercially and help them out.
Thank you, Simon. Belinda, do you have anything to add?
Well, I think, from an economics point of view, being very focused on Australian diversifying its export base from resources. So education, tourism has been a big driver of that, but China's been the number one destination for both of that. So I think it's just a need to diversify further. But human capital is effectively what you're talking about. Human capital is such an important driver of you know, potential growth for the Australian economy. So any policies that can help contribute to that will be very important.
Thanks, Belinda. So I have more questions, but that wasn't part of the deal. So are there questions from the audience?
Thank you. Jenny Hill, Mayor of Townsville. I wanted to just get some ideas really around about the here and now. Coal exports are important. We're seeing allegedly Glencore capping their coal exports and the issue of China reducing exports from Australia. That's a big dollar for both the federal and state governments and confidence in the community. Is this really about global warming or is it really about trade war and Huawei?
So glad you raised it. It was on my list of things to talk about, but I went so long with my effusive introductions and thanking people they didn't get to it. So, coal is tricky because global demand for it is probably tracking down over the short, medium, long term. Maybe not short term, but certainly medium and long term. China's far and away the big story here. I tend to think we overstate the way that other factors, so to speak, might influence Chinese decisions about to take our what they're doing with that coal in their, I think it's their number three port, and the actual quantum we're talking about at this point is actually a very small proportion of the total coal that is exported from Australia in total, but to China in particular. I think we often overestimate the extent to which strategic imperatives may be at work, and it's more just to do with things going on inside China. So some really good analysis of that I read on that particular decision is that if you look at their import stats, they really ran it up hard last quarter of 2018, and there's just so much coal piled up in China. It's an inventory. Imports ran at record levels fourth quarter of 18. And they're just hitting pause for a little while. China doesn't mind if that throws Australian policymakers into fits of, you know, angst. That's to their interest to some extent as well. But I think it's a more benign story in the immediate term than anything sort of with a strategic sort of motivation. I think the bigger issue about coal is the longer term structural one. And Queensland, perhaps in particular, you know, can't, and Australia in turn, shouldn't be thinking of that as a you know, in the way it has, perhaps. Now that'll be a slow burn because the demand for the stuff is just so big in North Asia. It's not just China, right? There's plenty of other big markets for it as well. So it's not going to happen overnight, but I think that's the bigger thing to think about. And the third thing I'll say, I promise, and last thing on that, is I am far more focused on the US-China trade talks and Australia's exposure to that displacement potential there is what I'm talking about. That does Trump, looking at the US needing less coal because it's got so much LNG, think, wow, how do I export more coal to China? Because right now the US exports almost nothing coal-wise to China. The US is coming at us like a freight train on LNG, by the way. Australia's going to have 3 years in the sunshine where we're the world's number one LNG exporter. We will be overtaken in 2024 by the United States as the world's largest exporter of LNG. And does Trump look at the trade negotiations with China as an opportunity to bring that moment forward? Putting energy exports out of the US into the ensemble of things he wants out of China. What are the implications of Australia out of that? Now, we've got long-term contracts locked in. I think we are protected from some risk, as your presentation laid out. But I am way more focused on that, frankly, as a commercial strategic risk to Australia than, for the time being at least, that one decision about one port, which I think has a more benign explanation than that. But
no, I totally agree. I think for us, I think we thought that shouldn't impact Australia's exports too much. It's less than 2% of our coal exports go through that port. I think we are much more concerned about looking at China's potential growth rate in the future. So China's growing at, you know, 6.4% at the moment. Over the next 10 to 15 years, we think China's growth will slow to 4%. So for us, it's what does that mean for our resources, for our other exports? We're much more focused on that story.
And the Chinese growth story, I think, could be, yes, the trade war with the US doesn't help, but Chinese growth was getting on a, starting to trend down in any event, and I think it's those factors, and perhaps it's creditworthiness, you know, internal financial markets, factors endogenous to China, if you will, could be kind of more relevance to its growth number and implications from Australia than anything directly impacting its growth number out of the trade stuff.
Thank you. I think we have a question in the back and then one at table four. We'll go to table four. I'm not seeing the microphone back there. Thanks.
Lucas Dow, CEO of Adani Mining. Belinda, we heard you, at the back end, you sort of alluded to the prospect of tax cuts with the budget. Interested in your thoughts and how CBA is thinking about implications of, I guess, the reverse, increased taxes and the application. So maybe two parts, increased tax and the implications of negative gearing as playing out in the housing market.
Two great questions. So we think income tax cuts, obviously already in the budget. We think that will come through lower and middle income earners over the next few years. We do think there'll be more. So in the mid-year budget that was released in December, there's close to $9 billion in a contingency reserve for further income tax cuts. Now, when we look at the outlook for consumer spending... So for us, when we look at the consumer outlook, we are very much focused on the lower to middle income earners. They have a much higher marginal propensity to consume, so we think that could help buffer the consumer outlook. On the flip side, a change of government, we know there'll be changes to negative gearing over time. We don't know when, but obviously in a deteriorating housing market, when you have investors certainly weighing up the prospect of entering the market, a potential change to negative gearing would no doubt be keeping more on the sidelines. So it'd be very hard to implement that when the housing market continues to deteriorate. We think it will continue to deteriorate over the course of this year, so it might come down to timing. So when we think about the outlook for the consumer, we need income growth. There are a number of ways that can happen, but we think tax cuts will be part of that story.
Okay, Simon, anything to add?
No, I'll let the...
All right, thank you. We have a question in the back. Have we found the microphone in the back? Is there a question in the back?
No.
Okay. Are we finished then, time? Okay, sorry.
Sorry, I do have one other one.
Okay.
No, it's a great question. If you're looking to diversify in all sorts of ways, there's this huge market there, obviously. On the strategic defence side, there's some baby steps happening. This concept of the Quad, which is Australia, India, Japan, United States, is likely to remain a very informal gathering of consultations and loose coordination rather than anything formal. And in part that's India sort of being reluctant to go too far down that road. At that level of sort of grand national strategy, India is very much hedging its bets and will do what's in India's interests, despite the overtures from, I think, the United States, Japan and Australia would very much welcome a more forceful voice from India in terms of forming a block of democracies sort of advocating for a different road for the region and for the entire Indo-Pacific. But I think it would be a mistake to bet the farm on India. India will emerge as a counterweight economically and perhaps strategically as well, if it wants to. But it's up to India if and when it does that. That's sort of, a summary of sort of the way the strategic affairs community, at least, is thinking about India. And economically, I think it's people in the room would probably know better than me, but when I talk to business people, you know, and we can maybe run a show of hands here, where would you rather do business, China or India? You know, and any time I've run that experiment in recent years, and I run it in the United States, China wins that by a comfortable margin. Now, I haven't run it for a while, and in the United States, that experiment, but the sense of the cost of doing business of India versus the cost of doing business in China, and the cost of doing business in China are changing. But I'd be very interested if you got a perspective on
that. Well, it's interesting. I've been an economist now for over 15 years, but kind of at the beginning of that, it was always about China v India, like what's going to be most important for the Australian economy. And it really just goes to show you the ability of a command economy over an economy that's a lot more fractured, a political system that's a lot more fractured, and the issues with that. So you can really see, particularly recently with China's ability to support their economy, just how beneficial it has been for them to have, you know, that command economy in place, and they can certainly turn on the taps if they need to support growth, whereas India continues to really kind of lack that, you know, ability of the government to formulate policy, really.
Thank you. So I'm afraid we've run out of time for questions, and thanks very much to Belinda and Simon, and now Kyle.
Thank you.
Closing the event. Thank you, Kyle.
Thank you.